The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Simon Sharma.
Hello. What a pleasure to be at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I love that. No, I love that. There's no. It's sort of redundant because an enslaved library is an oxymoron. Tyrants tremble before the Dewey Decimal System and everything that succeeded it. It's fantastic, actually, in America, how libraries could light the flame of insurrection. I remember being very moved by discovering that Thomas Jefferson, in order to stoke what were already the considerable fires of his own indignation about the tyranny being exercised by George III, used to go to a local library in Williamsburg, and there he would read deeply in the debates of the English Civil War of the 1640s that ended up cutting off the head of the king. And you imagine him looking at the Putney debates and the discourses of the Levellers and the stirring parliamentary debates and think if, you know, that could happen really in the land of tepid tea and early to bed. Anything could happen in an American library. So you hope. So the Free Library of Philadelphia, you know, fantastic ghosts of Franklin. And I did want in this series actually to come to Philadelphia, partly because one of the programs was called American Fervor, which is about religion. And it was really particularly about black African-American and religion. And we had to make a choice between, so I'm here really in the spirit of reparation, between Savannah and Philadelphia. And somehow, you know, Savannah cuisine won over the cheesesteak. Don't ask me why. I know. Lousy taste, right? Exactly. Exactly right. So this project, both book and television, and I'd be happy to answer questions afterwards about how the writing is very different for both these forms of craft, which crafts I believe they are, actually. But both the book and the television project were born, I would say, half of desperation and half of exhilaration. The desperation part was not, actually, the sense of the Great Republic of the United States, in which I've spent half my life going to hell in a handbasket in 2006 and 7, although it might be argued it looked very much that way. No, the desperation was born of extreme frustration, actually, at the simplicities that were inflicted on descriptions of the United States by many of my friends and by opinion in Europe and in Britain in particular, with which I was very close, working as I do for the BBC. Among those simplicities were, for example, cowboy politics. You heard the same lazy cliches born of, you know, journalistic habits of occupying bi-coastal positions, preferably in a bar, and flying over the rest. You know, you'll be a long time before you find a BBC stringer in Duluth, for example, I would have thought. More's the pity. You know, some of those simplicities, cowboy politics, American militarism, religion in particular, gets up my nose when it's described in Britain as a prisoner of the evangelical right, when, of course, religion, an intensely important and noble part of America's history. I speak as someone really rather on the side of Jefferson's deism. Jefferson, by the way, how many of you think Jefferson... Oh, it's an easy question. There will be an exam, by the way. They told you that before we let you out, right? How many of you think Jefferson believed that Jesus was the Son of God? You are so clever, Philadelphians. God. I gave you that so you could all feel good about yourselves, but you didn't. Indeed, he sort of ran on a platform. You know, Adams is, and let's see, you know, you're a bottle of Burgundy to someone. What was John Adams's, John Adams, who must have had his own Lee Atwater, really. What was his most damning slogan in the election of 1800? It feels like just yesterday, the election of 1800, everybody, does it not? What was the most damning slogan against Jefferson? Come on, class. Someone. Very good. Who said godless? Okay, you get the bottle anyway. It's not quite right. And, yeah, but you get a half bottle. No, it was the election Adams ran on God or Jefferson and no God. And it's fantastic to think of Jefferson, of course, did believe in an almighty creator. He believed it was an absurdity to suppose the universe created itself. He was not a materialist. He was not an atheist. But he thought it was equally absurd. You know, the virgin birth, give me a break already. You know, sort of belied any possible rationality. Jesus, a great moral teacher, but not the Son of God. So religion is a complicated process in the United States. And above all, religion, of course, has been instrumental in the African-American community's sense of its own self-determination, both from the noble period of the antebellum slave churches all the way through to the civil rights movement. You can't possibly think of the civil rights movement having been effective without preaching and teaching. Riverside Church is just around the corner from where I teach at Columbia, right the way through to Barack Obama's involvement with the church. Both with Jeremiah Wright's church, but the church more generally. So it wasn't a surprise to me, although it may have been unpalatable to some of my liberal friends, to find that Obama actually wanted to continue George Bush's policy of faith-based initiatives. It actually is in keeping with his sense that that's not necessarily a reactionary move. So to cut a long story short, the desperation part was really trying to write a book, that would explore stories with you, with the American public, but also try and educate my friends out of these obtuse and opaque simplicities. And the biggest simplicity all I thought, was that in Europe during, as they tend to put it in a kind of entirely dispassionate way, as one of my friends said, the long, dark years of W, that Americans are basically an historically stunted culture. You know, it's this kind of snobby thing that British say, by which they mean, you know, there are kind of no medieval knights clanking around in rusty suits of armor in North Dakota, although, you know, we call those Harley Davidson riders, actually. But what they really mean is that history doesn't play a part in the formation of the continent. I said, absolutely not. Gore Vidal, one of the cleverest things and one of the most misleading things Gore Vidal ever said was to describe the United States as the United States of amnesia. The impression that history doesn't matter to the American people is derived, entirely understandably, by the mind-numbing phenomenon called the social studies textbook. In fact, folks, can we... Philadelphia, famous for firebrand causes, tonight, in this room, at this moment, launched the campaign to abolish the dreaded words, social studies. Yes! Take back the discipline. We are going to call it history. Okay. Yeah, because history is about flesh and blood. It's about memory. And, of course, all you know that, you know, beach blockbusters are another doorstopper in the life of Benjamin Franklin. Very wonderful they are, too. David McCullough and John Adams, Ron Chernow and Alexander Hamilton. Americans live and breathe history in a way in which Europeans imperfectly understand, because it's the remit of the Supreme Court in the first place to interpret the wish of the founding fathers every single day and week during which Supreme Court is in session. In order to make the Constitution, that living, breathing, organic thing, work. It was actually a Scot, Lord Bryce, actually, who was the sort of closest that the British got to Tocqueville, who tried to educate his own countrymen back in Britain on the vitality, the enduring vitality, precisely because it was always open to discussion, debate, and interpretation of the Constitution. And sometimes one feels, when one listens to the historian-in-chief in the White House, who can barely make a speech, really, without invoking, as he did, somewhat mournfully, I have to say, Washington staring gloomily at the ice floes at the crossing of the Delaware at the end of the inaugural speech, whoa, there's a kind of warm and cuddly moment for the folks, actually, as freezing as we all were out there in Washington on that great and glorious day. You sometimes have the impression that, you know, Obama is getting the very best advice from a crack cabinet because it consists of Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and Abraham Lincoln, with whom he somewhat compulsively identifies. So there is this sense, actually, I think, of the founding fathers, because they debated what America was to become, the possibilities of America. America was founded as an act of separation from the vice and misdemeanors and errors and poltroonery of the miserable old world of so many blood-bolted Machiavellis. It would be a new thing in the world. It would be a place in which you could become an American, irrespective of tribe or origin or nation or class, simply by virtue of subscribing to the great democratic ideal of freedom, unless, of course, oops, you were black. Something that has now, at last, that long art of disingenuous hypocrisy been exorcised by the 44th Prez. So there is this sense in which I think history matters. It matters deeply in America, and it matters once one's, you know, out of the crushing tyranny, and I mean this orthopedically, of the social studies curriculum textbook. Part two of our campaign, which you've all signed up for, there are subscription envelopes way at the back there. We've all just abolished social studies. We are moving on to abolish the textbook produced. But anyone work for McGraw-Hill here? I hope not. You're out of a job. Macmillan, you're gone. But there is this sense, actually, which past and present really are married together in the American experience. And I say it rashly. When Obama was actually beginning the campaign and not doing very well, actually, sort of towards the end of 2007, but long before the Iowa caucus, scenes from which you've just seen, that really I thought that actually the person who would win the election, whether it be a Republican or a Democrat, Hillary or Obama, whoever, would be the person who actually commanded the best story in the dreaded N-word narrative, to tell the American people why, because the American people needed to be given back suffering, needed to be given back a sense of the trajectory of their story. What Obama has, rather miraculously, I think, actually, is sort of sense, and it's intuitive. It must have been those 4 o'clock in the morning lessons in which his hippie mother inflicted him before the dawn of Jakarta. No, but she was extraordinary. She was, you know, Benjamin Franklin would have liked this kind of hippie who said, really, learn, Barack, learn. You know, what she said wonderfully, it's no picnic for me, Buster, either, when he complained. How many of you have read Dreams from My Father? And yeah, it's a fantastic book, isn't it? So fantastic, it doesn't feel like a book written by a politician, and it reads that way because it wasn't. He wasn't, in fact, a politician when he wrote it. And he was supposed to write an account of the campaign becoming president of the Harvard Law Review, but had these wonderful explorations of where he came from, identity, to discuss anyway. But the sense that Obama has is of seeing our moment, our difficult, grievous, tough, thorny, rough moment in American history in the great arc of our shared fortunes. And what he will have to preside over, I believe, is an even, you know, it may not have the kind of terror and pain of one's high street bank being about to close its doors, but it will, in the long term, be a transition for America from Henry Luce's grandiose idea of the omnipotent American century through to an America which somehow understands tough realities in the world. We understand, for example, that we can't go on just simply squandering away natural resources. We understand that America is becoming an interestingly colored multicultural place in a way in which Franklin, don't know if any of you had a look, I was astonished to find Franklin paranoid about the threat, the German threat, actually, he was so obsessed with the excellence of the Scottish, Irish, and definitely number three in the list, English, composition of the American population, that he actually thought Germans were not quite ready, you know, ready to actually take upon themselves the duties of citizenship. He was also even more worried about the Swedes, whom he described as tawny. Who is he looking at, actually, when he saw, you know, Harkon the Dusky, you know, Sven with a great sense of rhythm, you know, so no idea. So, you know, Obama has this sense, actually, of America's place at the moment, and he needs to give us that sense of how it's possible to remain in America and yet have a sense of our limits. Limits is not really an American word, and it's a word we brush up against with a sense of unbecoming friction. Jimmy Carter was a wonderful president in some ways, but he was absolutely hopeless at that. He didn't really want to somehow bring together American ingenuity and resourcefulness and a sense of sustained patriotic energy. He wanted to make us feel sinful. William Buckley, mischievous man that he was, had a point when, after listening to one of Jimmy Carter's sermon-like harangues on the television, said, until that last night, I hadn't realized that God was a member of President Carter's cabinet, you know, and a rather ferociously Calvinist God as well. So there is this sense, actually, of America, and the reason this title of the book is slightly overcute, The American Future, History, was born out of the conviction that there are certain moments, even though it's thought to be in some schools of the academy, a no-no for historians to project back from the present moment issues from the past. Because of the way Obama was, because of the historical stories he liked to tell, because of the thirst for history in American public culture, I must say, I think the first time I realized this was when I was a young, and you'll be astounded to hear, slightly feckless Don, although in Cambridge, I was having to teach. I remember one Tuesday morning in 1967, I taught Peter Abelard in the morning and Adlai Stevenson in the afternoon. I haunted by what they would have made of each other, actually, if I... I don't think Eloise would have gone for Adlai, unfortunately, really. Not in the way she went for him, anyway. But I remember leaning out of the window and these two sweet old ladies came through the Tudor gateway of Christ College, Cambridge, and one said to the other, "Oh, Mabel, don't you just love history? It's so old." And I... In my point of life, I appreciate this, actually, a testimony. So it is old and it's young at the same time. So this sort of cross-fertilization between the present moment struck me as a good, if risky, project to undertake. Because I thought what one might do in both the films, the four films we made for the BBC, we're about to start shooting a couple which will be follow-up films. We're going to be shooting The President on Omaha Beach on the 65th anniversary of D-Day, which, if you can't find some of his most grandiloquent words, you know, on that particular occasion, then his gifts will have deserted him, and I very much doubt they will. But I was also a journalist when I graduated from college and was never quite sure which I wanted to be. Between doing Abelard and Adlai Stevenson, I worked for Harold Evans on the Sunday Times of London, then in its rather glorious investigatory journalist phase, in a very, very small role, just a couple of days a week, hired by a friend of mine who's working for the paper. I work for occasional magazines, reputable and sometimes not, and sort of kept my finger in. And I felt that really it was the job, in a way, of a good journalist to almost write the first draft of history. I was lucky, you know, so much in life, really. I was the sort of undeserved legatee of dumb luck, in that in Cambridge in the 1960s, you did two kinds of history, basically, and I'm inevitably simplifying a bit. Goodness, how time flies when one's having fun, actually. Where is young Andy? Stand up and be counted. There you are, my dear. How long do I have? This sounds alarming. Sounds like Robespierre or something. Your life will expire in 3 minutes. And I'm counting now. 2 minutes 59, 2 minutes 58. Yes? 8:15. All right, the guillotine drops at 8:15. See? He's standing there, the sort of skinny kid with the curly hair. Yeah. Go get him. You interrupt our fun at your peril, Buster. There were two kinds of history you could do, and they have a great and honored pedigree, both of them, in the life of history itself, going really all the way back. In the 19th century, when history became a university department, that gloomiest of all phrases, The great one was in Oxford, founded by a man called Bishop Studds, who was a great medievalist, genuinely great, no irony intended at all. But Studds was horrified by what he thought of as the contamination of history by loose literature. He had in mind, admittedly, slightly egregious examples, like the author of The Water Babies, Charles Kingsley, becoming rather mysteriously Regius Professor in Cambridge. But he also had in mind, and since I've just been shown in a state of shock and reverence, Charles Dickens's desk upstairs, he had in mind the close relationship between Dickens and Thomas Carlyle, for example. Carlyle, we're told, I think it's true, actually, wheeled much of his library on the French Revolution round to Dickens in his wheelbarrow around the corner from Chelsea. And that was just the kind of thing that Stubbs hated. He felt this was a kind of vulgar, as I say, contamination. And instead, what the historian had to model himself on was a kind of monk who simply locked himself in the archive, opened the boxes of document medieval manor rolls, and then tuned in a kind of mysterious Star Trek-y way to the mysterious vibes that came out of the manorial rolls, of which he was the interlocutor. The historian's job was utter self-effacement, was the objective presentation of raw archival material to his students, who would then go on. So editing was scholarship. Interpretation was a no-no. Interpretation was the interposition of your subjective views between you and the raw surviving evidence of the past. And the English Historical Review, which Bishop Stubbs founded, was the kind of institutional expression of that super ascetic, austere view of what history was. Now, a different view survived, which went in the following way, that give me a break, basically, it's the give me a break school, which said there is no history without personal interpretation, because guess what? History isn't the record of everything everyone's done since, you know, the first caveman came grunting, having completed his, you know, last eland on the walls of Lascaux or something. History is above all an ordering in terms of significance about what counts and what does not count when it addresses itself to big questions. Who knows? We've got a bottle of, I'm feeling big, you know, Prosecco. Who knows? Who knows? In the first sentence, which you've all read, class, Herodotus' histories. I, Herodotus of Halicarnassus, and he describes himself as being obliged to recite the Historia. And what does Historia mean, actually? Don't you love the Socratic method? Don't all the speakers who come here do this? What does Historia literally from the Greek mean? Not you, you've already won a bottle down there, so... No, well, it doesn't mean story. No, actually, it would be wonderful for, you know, storytellers like me for it to be. It doesn't really mean story. No. One more guess. What does someone say? Rope? Record. No, it means actually inquiry. So from the very first sentence, even though Herodotus was a sort of, you know, a rum writer, because he tended, as Thucydides rather, with some asperity, commented on to sort of confuse myth and gossip and history. I rather love him for that. Lord Macaulay called Herodotus a sweet child. Wonderful way of describing him. Herodotus at least knew when he was writing the history of the wars between the Greek and the Persians that you begin with a bloody great big question. Why the hell did it happen? And it is to that question that you deliver your ordering system for what's significant and what's insignificant kind of evidence. So given that you cannot escape in the writing of history personal subjective interpretation, the kind of monastic Bishop Stubbs view is a kind of fantasy, really, about history writing itself, about the imagined purity of the archive. So those who were historical interpreters carried on, but they were always a kind of distastefully regarded minority in universities. But I was lucky. I had a teacher called Jack Plum, who actually spent a lot of time in America, wrote for American Heritage. Some of the older among you may remember his beautiful writing. And Plum taught me, actually, that you weren't really a historian unless you wrote for the public as well as for academics. E.M. Forster, paraphrasing Rudyard Kipling in this context, said, "What do they of history know who only know other historians?" So there were, in the 60s in particular, historians who were the enemy of hermetically sealed ivory tower enclosure. And I have to tell you, letting down the side and letting out trade secrets. And one of the problems of the universities now in the United States is that academics are really all about each other. Professors are too much into the business of collective self-reproduction, producing kind of countless mini-me's who then go on to give the right kind of paper at the right kind of conference and get the right kind of job. And, you know, of the many things we can't afford, Hummers, we also really can't afford that kind of higher graduate instruction, I think. Oops, there's me out of a job. But short life, I'll just write cooking, you know, for the... Plum wasn't like that. Plum gave me my first review. I remember it very well. In 1965, I was still an undergraduate. It was a review of a book about the Battle of Waterloo by someone called David Howarth. And it was a terrific book, and it was for the Saturday Evening Post. That's how old I am, everybody. And I got $5 for it, and it was a fortune to me, and I framed the check. And it was a kind of my Hippocratic Oath. I swore, really, it solved the problem about, you know, green eyeshadow journalism or live the life of a scholar. Answer, do both. They are not mutually depleting. They are necessarily and obligatorily self-nourishing. You write for the public that you may write eloquent scholarship. You do scholarship that you may write for the public. And you write for the public as a friend and companion, but above all, as an authority with the impeccable integrity of research in primary sources. So you want to say, for God's sake, boys, make up already. Bishop Stubbs, meet Thomas Carlyle. Thomas Carlyle, meet Bishop Snubs, enough already. So I've been lucky enough to do that, and the American future was born in some sense of this complicated marriage between on-the-road journalism. And reflecting back, as Siobhan very kindly said, and we seem to run out of time to investigate in any depth, but that's okay because you can read the book. These four subjects on war and immigration and religion and plenty. And the reason I, you know, none of us quite saw the financial meltdown in the magnitude with which it happened. But, and I plead guilty to that, although I was going to make a fifth film, and therefore would have been a fifth chapter called American Money. But actually the BBC ran out of its own money. So this is unfortunately true. We are now making a film about morals and money, which is the story of the 1907 crash. But I thought, and I still do think, that actually when and if, as we devoutly hope, and the present government sort of gets us, we get ourselves, it's not the government getting us through, part of the most admirable part of Obama's project does seem to me to be about the restoration of America as a sense of mutual obligation. And the miracle of it was, I have to say, I think of that election campaign following it around, was that he said something very wise at the acceptance speech at Denver. He said, you can always make big elections small. He said, it's been tried. It's worked. And what he meant by that was Lee Atwater, I think. What he meant was that the proven success, also, of course, Karl Rove in 2004, was that it's all very well to talk about the great issues affecting America, American destiny, the deep structural problems, seriatim in all the fields that I've talked about. But, you know, Americans actually want politics to be a branch of entertainment tonight. Enough already with the high debates. Don't need that. Americans are sort of obtuse. It's a very, very patronizing view. The Roger Ailes, Lee Atwater, Ed Rollins, Karl Rove view. It really is a view of you can fool most of people most of the time, and it's called television advertising and spin and swift boatery. And wow, did it come gloriously unstuck in the months of our travail last year. And it was Obama's bet, I think. It probably was Hillary's too, but it was especially Obama's bet that, guess what? America did want to hear about the things which actually mattered to the life and death of the Republic. 2005 and 2006 sealed that possibility, or at least, I think, gave Obama the audacity to actually try and, hey, finish his sentences, something which hadn't happened for a while. And those of us going around the country, you know, it wasn't just the gradual sense in which we've all been sold a bill of goods about weapons of mass destruction and the relationship between the Iraq War and 9/11, or the non-relationship, but also it was Katrina, wasn't it? I remember giving a lecture in Norman, Oklahoma, rather a wonderful place, actually, and Oklahoma City, too, with that moving memorial, but not really somewhere normally in the Democratic side of the column, and lots of military families. And I remember I describe actually our driver in Iowa, but I was very struck by it in not long after. It must have been towards Christmas 2005, I think, not long after Katrina. And someone from a military family just described his stomach being turned. It wasn't the kind of you're doing a heck of a job brownie moment. He said it was the flyover. He said, I don't expect our government to do much. He said, I agree with Ronald Reagan. Government can sometimes be the problem, not the answer. But I do expect them to get the bodies out of the mud. It was really, we all want, as Americans, We want our government to be decent, and we want it to work. And I think the sort of sense of alienation from the idea of governance, you know, we're all so deafened by the relentless rant of the right-wing talk shows in which any kind of public service is a form of betrayal of our American credentials, that we forgot there was something noble and honorable and important and necessary about the elementary obligations of public service. And that, I think, actually, you know, taking a huge risk was what Obama gambled on in his campaign, and is indeed gambling, this sense of restored mutuality in trouble. And, of course, actually, had it not been for government, then, you know, we'd be in an even deeper and worse and more terminal hole than we actually are. But this seemed to be actually something that was lying out there in American history anyway. Wherever you looked, it was lying in, you know, what Lincoln had to say, certainly what Franklin Roosevelt had to say, that there was this, what you read in the records of the black churches in the 19th century that produced the most important educational programs for their people all through the long, miserable years of Jim Crow and Southern segregation, that there was lying richly in American tradition a sense of not having to apologize for decent government. And this is no guarantee that we're going to get it. There's no guarantee we're going to get it. But at least, you know, the young, my children's generation are poking their heads above the public service. My daughter's boyfriend, for example, is one of many, and I tell the story right at the end of the book of another, who gave up a fat job in corporate law in order to go into, of all places, the office of management and budget in the government, which is either the worst job in the world or the best job in the world, but in any case, have a sense of actually doing something again for the country. Many, many millions of Americans felt, I think, after 9/11, that there was a real opportunity for the president to actually stir and mobilize the altruism, which, you know, we've seen it all in any church bake sale, or any PTA. It's out there with an extraordinarily tough, impassioned sense of what it means to be part of an American community. So it was an extraordinary bet that Obama took, and he won the bet, I think, for me, appealingly, because he was prepared to embrace the power of language. Part of the Atwater Rove assumption, which went along with assuming that Americans were just turned off by politics, you know, and it turned out, what was it, 70 million people watched the first debate, that they were ready to listen to different kinds of language. And Obama came at them with a kind of extraordinary pincer movement. On the one hand, the language of our grandchildren, the language of the blog, the language of the web, which, you know, circumnavigated around the old tried and true campaign machinery of spin. And on the other hand, so brand new, contemporary, street mobilizing the kids and the students and mobilizing $10 at a time, a staggering amount of money for the campaign. And on the other hand, of course, what Obama brought back into American public life was the beauty of public rhetoric. Now, you'll all know that in the 19th century, you had to pass exams in rhetoric to get through high school in many states and in college. I actually gave the Phi Beta Kappa oration at Harvard some years ago, and it was called, with a sense of kind of rueful irony, The Fate of Eloquence in the Age of Ozzy Osbourne. But there were millions of little Ciceros all over America. Abraham Lincoln made himself one of them, of course. And of course, you know, you'd say the power, not just the sort of ornamental beauty of fine speaking, but the ability to actually be persuasive as a speaker was something which seemed to be absolutely sort of discounted in the world of campaign spin and takedown mutual character assassination. But Obama sort of delivered that. I mean, here, the greatest speech of all the campaign was on March the 18th, wasn't it? In the midst of the Jeremiah Wright. I mean, that was still remains one of the great speeches that, you know, has ever been composed in the history of American politics. And I thought that morning, we were filming in Monticello, actually, when he made that speech. And when I heard it, I thought, he's gone down in flames. You know, it's Hillary's. Hillary will be the nominee because this was an act of the most extraordinarily dead-on frontal candor, explaining to America the roots of black rage in the church forms they took, as well as alluding to white rage. But of course, actually, America took it. It was a credit to them, sophistication of the electorate, really, and its willingness to face something fresh, to actually face truths, even if they're a bit tough about American history, that instead of doing him irreparable and irreversible harm, it did him immediately an enormous amount of good, even though he had to distance himself further from, because Jeremiah Wright, you remember, inconveniently would not leave well enough alone, would not shut up, you know, at that particular point, really. But so I think we have a moment, really, in which the American future and the American past are this extraordinary, like, two wires in a kind of electrical connection. No, we can't use history, really, as a predictor of what will happen next. But you do know that, you know, whether it's wonderful books about Franklin Roosevelt's 100 Days or about the Depression, or whether it's about the end of the American century and, you know, where we go from here and our relationship with China and so on, one does know that what the richly informed bed of understanding which history gives us about America is something we absolutely need as we go on into a difficult future. It was Cicero who said, I regret to say plagiarized a bit by Jefferson and Lincoln, that those cultures who lose historical memory know not whither they can go because they know not whence they came. And I think whatever we can say about the 44th president, that's not a problem for him. And with our new campaign to abolish social studies, hey, a whole new life of American history lies before us. At any rate, we know whatever is in store for the American future. It is most certainly not the end of one particular story, but the beginning of a new, and I'm confident to say, spirited and noble chapter. Thanks, everyone. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Andy. I'm the skinny kid and director of author events here at the Free Library. I think most of you know how this works. Please raise your hand. We will get a microphone to you. And who would like to start us off? Simon,
this gentleman at the back.
Oh, you see somebody.
Andy, yeah.
Okay, all the way in back there.
Would you share a few of your thoughts about the outcome that you see with regards to attention, with regard to building the economy and protecting the environment?
That's a small subject you've asked me on. Yeah. This is going to be tough. You know, the chapter in called American Plenty is about America's expectations, really, that if you, and again, it's right to say this in the city of Franklin of Brotherly Love, that if you have enough resourcefulness and enough hard work, then the providentially granted expanse of the American continent, rich in natural materials, will always provide for abundance. But of course, we know that even if Sarah Palin had a wish and we drill, baby drill, you know, the whole of Alaska, we maybe would get 18 months more of oil for our reserves. So I think, you know, it wasn't just the, at least one hopes it wasn't just the $5 a gallon gas crisis of last summer and autumn, which made Americans, you know, wean them off SUVs and seal the doom of some redundant departments of Detroit and Dearborn, Michigan. But the sort of general, it's up to the educator-in-chief in the White House, as he's certainly been out there doing, just yesterday, in fact, actually, in laying down tougher rules about emission. It's up there to sort of educate the public that really, that our economic future in some sense depends how much short-term pain, and there will be an awful lot of pain, mostly, of course, in the collapse of the automobile industry, in transitioning to a greener future for us all. We really sort of have no choice. I mean, it's extraordinary irony. It doesn't quite answer your question, but I hope it's not completely irrelevant. I was in Shanghai quite recently, and you would think the Chinese would all be in gloat mode, really, at the moment. Our creditor, once our debtor, now our creditor. You know, if they turn in their bonds, the bottom falls out of what's left of the American economy. But actually, they're not. They're not at all. They are instead actually not wanting the American model to fail. But on the other hand, what they don't like is sort of the message that we really have to at least deliver to ourselves. Shanghai, and I've been in some polluted places in the world, São Paulo, for example. Shanghai really takes the cake. It is staggeringly turbid, with the most emphysema-ridden pollution of any place I've been in the world. It is the most raw, uncontained discharge of pollutants, and they're storing up all kinds of incredibly expensive and tragic problems for themselves. I'm not saying that, you know, America has to look to China as kind of cautionary lesson, but this is one of the transitions out of the expectation of easy abundance into a time where we're stewards of our own resources in the more responsible way. Now, this too is an American tradition, I have to say. One of the chapters in the book called American Plenty is about water, and water is a really going to be an absolutely incredibly major problem for the West in particular. The Lake Mead is running at just about 50% of capacity. I'm not sure what the snowmelt shortfall is this year, but I think it was projected to be dire. And when we were filming, when I was researching the book, I went to a place which about the most improbable place as a model of environmental stewardship, which is Las Vegas. One of the most impressive people I've ever met in American public life is a woman called Pat Mulroy, who runs the South Nevada Water Authority. All of those slightly over-the-top lagoons and fountains that decorate, if that's the correct word, the great hotels of Las Vegas is all recycled water. People are basking by the side of swimming pools, that it better not ask where the water comes from, although it's perfectly purified. But Las Vegas pays citizens to take up sod and lawn. You can see trucks driving off people's lawns and backyards and replace them with succulents and cacti and gravel. It pays them, I think, $1,000 a square foot. And Pat Mulroy reasonably complains about golf and front yards and runoff in places like Albuquerque and Phoenix and Los Angeles as being particularly wasteful and compounding an already difficult problem, and also intensely irrigated crops like alfalfa, for example. You wouldn't need as much alfalfa if you didn't actually do industrial cattle raising. Another of our campaigns, which we're about to start, everybody, aren't we all lucky tonight, is actually McBison, really. Bison are the answer, everybody, it turns out. The Plains Indians knew what the hell they were doing. Bison basically, you know, live on junk that grows. It live on thorns and prickles and weeds and don't actually need pasture of any kind, much less alfalfa. And how many of you cooked bison burgers? Good for you. Aren't they great? And they're not expensive? We can leave this room absolutely dripping with social virtue tonight, really, isn't it? That's probably enough as an answer to your question, yeah.
Shall we continue? About six rows back here.
Coming to the United States, I assume quite a while ago, but as an outsider, what was the essence that drew you here? Why was it attractive? Why did you want to come? And has that, do you still find whatever it was appealing? And why did you come?
Don't sound baffled, darling. Intellectual freedom's the answer. It's very simple. I'm part of the great, you know, Jewish world conspiracy in which, you know, there were brothers, and from my mother's family, I'm talking about the Steinbergs rather than the Sharmas, another story entirely, but the Steinbergs were from Lithuanian. They were actually Lithuanian lumberjacks, rather endearingly, actually. I always wanted to revise that famous Monty Python song, but with sort of crossed over with, you know, Fiddler in the Woods, actually, it should have been. They were Lithuanian lumberjacks, it's true. And there were four brothers, and three of them had the energy to go from London to Liverpool and make the Atlantic crossing and settle, of course, in Brooklyn. But my grandfather, Mark, the butcher, actually, was too lazy and stayed in London. But what this meant, the reason why a slight digressive answer to your question, was that we had an American family always when I was growing up. Uncle Elliot came in his rather beautiful American Air Force uniform, I remember, when I was a kid. We were close to our New York Steinberg. So in a sense, New York, when I came, if that's allowed to be America, Philadelphia, felt very much like home to me. It wasn't a surprise. But the intellectual freedom thing is serious. I got tired. I was raised in Cambridge, as I said, and I'm very grateful for the kind of liberty I was given by my doctor father to really write both popular history and scholarly history. But then I went to teach at Oxford, and there was a sense in which you were tied to an immemorial curriculum that never mind what you wanted to teach. And I was interested in kind of slightly crackpot things to do with the Dutch and cleanliness fetishes and really strange and wacky things. And I remember actually standing up and proposing at the Faculty of History a course on the history of the family, for example. And it was as though I remember being met with looks of roomy-eyed disbelief, as though I'd uttered some unspeakable profanity. And I thought, I've got to get out of here. And then I think the next day, I try to kindle the enthusiasm of one of my undergraduates in something very marginal, say the Russian Revolution. And I was met with that extraordinary twinkle, you know, which reminded me very much of what Cousin Jasper says to Charles Ryder in Brideshead Revisited. Treat the dons like the village parson and you won't go far wrong. I was sick of being treated like the village parson. I wanted to sort of wipe the smile off their elegantly country gentleman face. And what I really wanted was to be able to teach what I wanted. And Harvard sort of hired me for a term. You know, the first thing the department chairman at Harvard, this was 1979, said to me, and what would you like to teach? And no one had ever, what would you like to teach? Was just, you know, staggeringly trailblazing thing to say. So I was really, you know, a piggy in clover at Harvard. And I taught crossover things between art and history, as I've been doing ever since. And I've taught, you know, I found the American university much more hospitable to that kind of interdisciplinary exchange. And I would flirt around with anthropology and some philosophy of Kunstwissenschaften. And I often ask myself, I've written so many odd books, really, Landscape of Memory and so on, and whether or not, and The Embarrassment of Riches, whether I'd have done that if I'd have stayed in more conventional English university setting. And I'm actually not sure I would. So it's all America's fault.
Gentleman on the aisle there.
The impression that people get, or Jewish people get in the United States, is that British liberal intellectuals are hostile towards Israel and siding with the Palestinians and making the Israelis the villains in this terrible drama. And I was wondering, you know, you sort of have a foot in England and a foot in in Colombia, which is maybe another place where such views are prevalent.
And I just wondering, not stand up when you say that.
Okay, I'm
I'm
glad
teasing. All right, fine.
I'm glad to hear that if that's the case. Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
Well, you are right in the first half of the question. I think that but you didn't say liberal Jewish intellectuals in England, did you? You said liberal intellectuals. The paper I until recently, because I've changed paper, wrote a lot for The Guardian. I mean, and The Independent particularly has the kind of you know, extravagantly anti-Israel writing of Robert Fisk, for example. It's not really just the left. I mean, there is, of course, you know, you must remember the great conservative romance with The Purity of the Desert, T.E. Lawrence, but all Gertrude Bell and so on. The sort of sense in kind of romantic conservatism of the last century. Oh, God, that shows how old I am. I mean, I meant the 19th century as well as the 20th, in which the Arab was incredibly sort of idealized in a way. And the Jew, if you think about the sort of repellent figure of Melmoth in Trollope's Way We Live Now, for example, was a representative of insidious metropolitan commercial modernity. So there is a kind of slightly golf club patronizing snobbery about the Jew. You see it, I mean, Eliot picked it up, of course, when he came to England. You know, the Jew squats in the windowsill. You know, Bleistein with a cigar and so on. Pound had it in, you know, again, American, but it's very much in European style. So I think there is a sense on the right as well, but there's no doubt you're right that there is a degree of slightly unhinged hostility towards Israeli government policy. I'm not a great admirer of current Israeli policy. I'm sort of wet peace now, Nick, but I'm a Zionist. I believe in the Jewish state. I also believe in a Palestinian state. I'm a two-state solution person. But has it shadowed into, without daring to call itself that, a kind of furtive anti-Semitism? The answer is yes, in my view. And it's something, actually, which friends of mine who are Jewish public intellectuals, a phrase which slightly makes my blood freeze, but like Howard Jacobson, for example, and Jonathan Friedland are really aware of, and we just launch ourselves into print over it, actually. I refuse to be taken as an apologist for the Israeli government by picking out moments which are especially unsavory in anti-Semitic implications. I think it's actually worse in Britain than it is in Germany, for example. It is a peculiarly British thing, which I'm sort of worried about, and I fear growing, actually. Yeah.
A few more questions. On the aisle here in the white.
It seems to me a little ironic that you should be advocating the abolition of social studies in favor of
only
history.
Only the name.
Well,
the subject.
In our high school controversies, on the one hand, you've got the new approach, which is social studies or cultural world history.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, just history. And I thought I was on your side in advocating, or you were on my side in advocating just history. But now, when you describe Oxford and Cambridge, you seem to be advocating and your own versatility, cross-disciplinary versatility.
I think there's something different from school teaching, high school teaching, and university teaching. What I want, I think we are really culturally unevolved, that's a very strong term to use, unless our kids know the story. So, I'm, you know, I'm with you. Unless our kids in high school and middle school, what I hate, again, is all the time and effort spent on in middle school about learning, you know, sort of Zits 101, really. But what I think our children must know is the basic outline of the American and world historical stories, which means chronology. It means chronology. It means narrative. It means information. It means not assuming that everything reliable can be got from Wikipedia. So I think that's a sort of absolutely critical apprenticeship beyond which one can fool around fruitfully, I think, with cross-disciplinary interest in university. So I hope we're on the same side.
Lady in the middle here, about four rows back. You can keep your hand up, miss.
Since you go from Bernini and Caravaggio to, Cicero, etc., is there anything peculiar about your approach to history and art that makes you such a fantastic, sparkling with all sorts of things?
I paid her to say that. Oh, shucks. I tell you, what's your name? What's your telephone number? I'm joking. Yeah. I always, from the Embarrassment of Riches onwards, it came with the Embarrassment of Riches. I always loved art. I wrote art reviews for the TLS, Times Literary Supplement, when my friend John Gross started to introduce non-book reviews. And he knew I was doing all this kind of weird iconological analysis. It seemed to me that when I wanted to write this book about, what daily life was like in Holland, on the strange thing of this tiny, tiny culture being the richest and most mighty place in the world for, a brief couple of generations, I thought, well, how ridiculous to do it. It's not just painting, but this is a kind of culture that's absolutely engorged on images, on tiles, on engraved glasses, on wallpaper, on stamped leather. You cannot do it without actually understanding the purchase and power of images of all kind, not just, high art images. And then as the years, went by, and I mentioned that course I very happily and gratefully taught in Harvard, I came to think of really that, on the one hand, art history couldn't really be taught or consumed altogether without understanding the rest of the world that kind of produced it. I'm not somebody who believes that you simply dissolve Picasso or Manet or Rembrandt or Leonardo entirely so they become a kind of function of grain prices or stock exchange. They are what they are. But it is very important to understand the kind of humus, as it were, the kind of the bed, the soil bed from which produced this particular work and that particular visual language. Equally, it is impossible to do history, especially history of the 20th and 21st century, but I don't know, any history since the printed image, or maybe any history since Bibles began to be illuminated, without seeing images as important intrinsically as text. Images are text, text is images, The two, that's how we are. We're language animals, but we're visual animals too. The two things marry each other, and what they give birth to is our culture.
And that's where we have to end it. Simon Sharma.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.